As I mentioned last week, probably will take a break for the summer, but I wanted to do the book of Ruth before we did. Ruth is traditionally done this time of year by the synagogues. It's the thing that they read for Shavuot. Now, of course, Shavuot was on Sunday, so we're late, but it obviously coincides with the wheat harvest. And the thing I don't understand, which I think is kind of funny, is most of the action in Ruth takes place at the barley harvest. But they don't read it during Passover or unleavened bread. They read it at Shavuot, which is the wheat harvest, and that's the way they do it. So the book of Ruth is short. I am not really planning to get done with it tonight. Probably 2 weeks we'll get done with it. Nobody knows who wrote it, but since we have the genealogy of David at the end, it was after the reign of David. Some things about it that are, I think, strange. It's a lovely book, but the names of the two sons of Elimelech, Mahlon and Chilion. Mahlon means sickly, and Chilion means pining or sad. And if I were naming my two sons, I'm not sure I would choose sickly and pining or sad. And of course, they don't play any part in the actual meat of the story, other than they have married Ruth and Orpah, and they die. I mean, that's sort of their entire thing in the story. And the fact that they do die validates their names, if you will. And so I am almost of the opinion, at least it's an idea that I entertain, that those names are made up. You all know your English literature, and you've probably either read or heard of Pilgrim's Progress. The names of the characters in there are descriptions of their role in the play. So Christian is the name of the hero, and you have similar names for all the other players. So Mahlon and Chilion sort of feel like that kind of authorship, if you understand what I'm saying. Don't know that they are. As I say, nobody knows who wrote the book. Nobody knows when it was written. And by the way, that's the only two mentions of those two guys in Scripture. So may have been their actual names, and their parents really weren't impressed with them when they were born, or who knows. The other thing is, what we're going to have in this book is the coming together of the disparate lines of the offspring of Terah. Terah, of course, is Abraham's father, and Terah had three sons. Hezron died, and the other one is Lot's parents. So you wind up having Lot and his group, and Moab comes from Lot. It's the son of one of Lot's daughters. You know, when they're off in the cave after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the daughters say, oh, there's nobody to carry on our father's line. And so the two of them get him drunk and cohabit with him, and they each have a son, Moab and Ben-Ami. So the Moabites come from Lot, who is the nephew of Abraham. So when Ruth marries in to Judah, everything comes back together. We'll go through that more next week than this week. I've got charts with genealogies and all that kind of stuff that you can actually see it. But the book brings together a whole bunch of stuff. It also is obviously a textbook case of Levirate marriage, the idea that if a man dies without issue, then the nearest relative takes his widow, and the firstborn child from that widow is counted as the child of the dead father. And that will become important toward the end of Ruth. And obviously we have the line of David established, since the genealogy ends with David. We also have the importance of Bethlehem established, and Bethlehem is where the Messiah is to be born. And at the time of Yeshua's birth, everybody recognized that Bethlehem was the place where the Messiah was going to come from. So all of that kind of stuff is wrapped up in this little book. It's also a wonderful love story. There's some interesting stuff there too. So let's start. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. And of course, in that society, as in most traditional societies, the duty of the children is to take care of their aging parents. And of course, when their mother is widowed, she loses her source of support and everything else, and her sons take that over. Used to be that way in the United States before the government got involved and we got Social Security and got all that disconnected, which is not a good thing. Verse 4. These took Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. So what you have now are three unattached women whose means of support is unknown. Certainly, as I say, Naomi would have been dependent on her two sons, and when they're gone, I don't know if Orpah and Ruth had any means of support at all, but things are looking pretty grim. Verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. Remember, the original reason why everybody left was because there was a famine, and they figured that opportunities would be better in Moab. Well, the famine has apparently broken and things are better in Judah. So from Naomi's point of view, Judah is where her extended family is. So if she is going to be a widow without any support, assuming economics are good in Judah, she's going to be better off in Judah than she would as a stranger in Moab. Verse 7. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. So they pack up and are setting out. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me." So she is going back to her people, where she should be able to come up with some kind of support. And she is saying to the Moabite gals, you do the same thing. Go back to your people because your chances of either remarrying or getting some kind of support among your own people is going to be better than it is in Judah. That's the setup. And also, she is complimenting them with the fact that they have stuck with their husbands. They've been loyal. They have dealt well with her. And when she was a widow and her two sons were alive, the two daughters-in-law apparently dealt well with her and so forth. So the relationships are cordial and everybody is on good terms. Verse 9, the Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. In other words, go get married. And you're both young enough that you should be able to marry and have a life with another husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husband?" The idea is she is thinking of levirate marriage. A, she doesn't have a husband herself, but if she did, the children that she bore would be the heirs to Elimelech. And so it would be those children's responsibility to marry the widows and get descendants for Elimelech. That's the thing that's sort of implied in that statement. What she's obviously saying is, I am an old woman, which is to say, I have got two grown sons who are now dead, and from the time my sons got married, it was another 10 years before they died. So assume that they married in their 20s. So by the time they died, they would have been in their 30s. And her age would have been very likely as old as 50 at that point. So it's entirely possible that her childbearing years are over. And I have no prospects of marrying and producing children. And if I did, it would be 20 years before they would be eligible to marry, which is to say, by that time, you having children is going to be iffy because you're going to be older women. So she's saying, all right, it ain't going to work. Go find husbands among the Moabites while you're still young and attractive and start a new life. Verse 12, turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. What she's saying is this is not going to work, and I am very sad for your sakes because you are also widowed. Go back and find a husband. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, see, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. And that speech of Ruth is obviously a lovely speech. It's been set to music by a number of composers and obviously very famous. Now, the other thing to understand here is Ruth is a young woman. Her mother-in-law is old. So I am assuming here, this is me, that A, of course, she loves her mother-in-law. They have a good relationship and she loves her. But the other thing is she doesn't want her mother-in-law not to have anybody that can work to support them. She doesn't want to throw her mother-in-law to whatever happens at the next town in Judah. She feels responsible to help care for her mother-in-law because, as I say, she's a young, strong woman. And as we'll see in a bit, she gets out and gleans and she works hard and all that kind of stuff. So I suspect part of what's going on there, and certainly there's affection there, but the other part of that is responsibility. I got to take care of my mother-in-law. I think both of those things play into her decision. The other thing is, if you read that carefully and pay attention, you will notice that Naomi tells the two young women three times to go. It is my understanding, without any particular evidence, that if you try and convert to Judaism, in modern Judaism, they will tell you three times no and try and talk you out of it three times. And if you persist past the third time, then they will take you as a proselyte and begin the process of turning you into a Jew. It is my understanding that that tradition comes from here. In order for a Gentile to come in, you want to make sure that they are, in fact, serious and committed. So if anybody knows any different, by the way, I don't have any particular authority for that, but that's what I've been told, that they will pro forma tell you three times, no, go away. And after the third time, if you persist, then they will take you on as a proselyte. Let's do 18 again. And when Naomi saw it, that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" So it's a small town. Everybody knew Elimelech. He was a property owner, among other things. And it has been well over 10 years, because we don't know how long Elimelech lived after he left. All we know is the 10 years after his death until the death of his two sons. So it could have been 15 or 20 years since anybody had seen him, but it's a small town. And so when Naomi comes back, they look at her, "Is that Naomi?" You all remember the story of the prodigal son. Middle Eastern village culture, if you will. When the prodigal son comes back, one of the ways that I've heard it described is the whole village was sitting at their windows with bags of popcorn because they were expecting a major blow up when this ne'er-do-well young man shows up and his father sees him. And that is why the father hikes up his skirt and runs out to him. So what his father is doing is he's short-circuiting that by showing everybody, "I am accepting my son. Go back to work. Go do something else because there's not going to be any show here." So here you have Naomi coming back after having left with a husband and two sons. And she's now coming back alone with a stray young woman with her. What happened? And that's why I say, is this Naomi? Verse 20, she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara." Mara means bitter, of course. "Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi, when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So they got there at basically Passover. The time hack here becomes important. Barley harvest begins on the day after the Sabbath at Passover. When you bring the wave offering, you bring your first fruits of the barley and wave it before the Lord, that's when the barley harvest kicks off. Comment was, I said that it's at the beginning of the barley harvest and the barley harvest starts at the Feast of First Fruits. And Michael said correctly that it doesn't say you can't harvest your barley, it simply says you can't eat it until first fruits. Given that you have standing barley in the field, I'm sort of assuming that we're at Passover time because they are harvesting barley, so there's standing barley in the field, which means that that is the month of Passover. So now chapter 2. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." Remember, one of the things I said earlier is Naomi is an old woman. And having a strong young woman in the household who can go out and glean and so forth like that, she is a support to her mother-in-law. So what I said earlier is the affection between Ruth and her mother-in-law also involves Ruth having a sense of responsibility that she needs to make sure her mother-in-law doesn't starve. So Ruth is able to go out and glean. I'm assuming Naomi is probably a bit old to be doing that. Now, you all know that in that culture and in the Torah, it specifically says that when you reap your fields, you will not reap all the corners and all the way out to the edges. You will leave that for the fatherless, the widow, and the sojourner. So the Torah explicitly says that gleaning is okay. I have a brother-in-law who used to be a dairy farmer. He's now a bank president, but he used to be a dairy farmer. Very successful dairy farmer. That's how he got to be a bank president. I think he had the second largest dairy farm in Washington State for a while. And so he would plant fields of feed corn for his cows, alfalfa and all these crops. And the feed corn was for his own dairy. So he would plow and plant cow corn in the middle. And then the last set of rows around the edge of the field by the road, he would take the cow corn out and put sweet corn in the drill. So the first six rows along the road were sweet corn. And they were specifically there so people could come up and take it. And my sister used to laugh because you'd see people sneak up and run in there and grab some corn and drive off real quick. You know, thinking they had stolen some corn. When, the first six rows in from the road all the way around was intended for people to come and take sweet corn. The same idea here. And he's a very strong, devout Lutheran, very good man. And that was part of how he ran his farm. And I suspect that the blessings he got were partially because of that. So anyway, she's going to go out and do some gleaning. Verse 3. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. She happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz says to his young man, who is in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman, who came with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." A couple of things. Thing one is, obviously, she's working hard. She started off first thing in the morning, and she has been working all day and gleaning. The second thing, I am very much assuming that she is decorative, because Boaz, who's that? And, of course, when he finds out who she is, that's when the story goes. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." So what he's basically saying is, you are an unattached young woman. This is the time of the harvest. You have all of the young men out there in the field reaping and binding sheaves and working hard. And it is possible that an unattached young woman in that milieu would be a target. So what he's telling her is, you stay in my fields with my people because I have told them that they are not to mess with you. The other thing about this that is noteworthy, as I say, is she is a hard worker. In all ways, this story is depicting a woman of exceptional character. Verse 10, "Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, 'Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I'm a foreigner?' But Boaz answered her, 'All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge.' Then she said, 'I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants.'" Remember, one of the things that she said in the speech at the end of chapter 1 is, "Your God is going to be my God." And so part of the reason why she is leaving is religious, in addition, as I say, to the fact that she is of good character, responsible for her mother-in-law, and obviously has genuine affection for her. The point is, Boaz knows what the story is. Verse 14. And at the mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some of the bread and dip your morsel in the wine." Some of your translations will have vinegar. I don't know whether it's sour wine or wine, probably vinegar, but my translation says wine. Lots of translations will say vinegar. "Dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied and had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." Understand what's going on. Gleaning is legal. However, even poor people get aggressive and greedy. So you've got a harvest going on, and you've got strangers wandering around gleaning, and you sort of have to keep an eye on them to make sure that they don't glean some of the sheaves that you have already stacked. So what Boaz is telling these guys is, yeah, I understand that you would normally keep gleaners at a distance from where you're working and at a distance from the sheaves you have stacked. Not with her. Let her glean even among your sheaves, and furthermore, leave some intentionally for her so that she is able to have a good day gleaning. Verse 17. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. So she's got about 3/5 of a bushel, or 60% of a bushel, which is a good day. And that, by the way, is threshed grain that she's got 3/4 of a bushel of. A very good day. When we make bread by grinding our own wheat, we make a loaf of bread from a couple, 3 cups. So you can sort of get the idea that she's got a fair amount of food there. 18. And she took it up and went to the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So her mother-in-law is very impressed with how well she has done gleaning for the day. Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close to my young men until they have finished my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." I don't know if you've ever been in a farm community during harvest, but you've got the guys reaping grain, and typically the women are busy cooking because you work up serious appetites. So the fact that women are out there as well, it doesn't necessarily mean they're reaping. What it means is they're cooking and feeding people. The other part of that, of course, is Naomi says, "Stay with them, lest you go into another field and somebody assaults you." So we have a close relative that you have found. You found favor in his sight. Stay with him, and you'll be safe, and obviously you will do well in your gleaning in that process. The other thing that is going on here, which just sort of gets mentioned casually, in verse 20, the man is a close relative of ours and one of our redeemers. You've all been through the Torah a whole bunch of times and recognize that if somebody falls on hard times, for example, a Hebrew family or a Hebrew man falls on hard times and can't support himself, he can sell himself as a slave, indentured servant, for up to 6 years. It is possible at any time that a near relative has the right to redeem him by basically paying off the rest of his contract. The other thing that goes with that is land. Every 7 years, all debts are canceled. The length of time of a indentured servant's contract is up to 6 years. So if you sell yourself as a slave and you got 5 years to go, what they would do is figure out what wages your employer would pay you during that time, and you can pay the balance and you can get him out. That's redeeming. The other thing, of course, is every Hebrew has attached to him land that was distributed during Joshua's time. And right now we are in the time of the judges, which is a reasonably short period after the division of the land. So theoretically, every Hebrew has land associated with him. And at the Jubilee, all the land goes back to its original owner. One of the things that will work out in this story is the fact that Naomi has a piece of land that belonged to her husband. Now, I don't know that she is leasing it out to anybody. Elimelech may have sold it to somebody, but when you sell land in biblical Israel, what you are selling is the crops that that land will produce between the time of the sale and Jubilee. You're not buying a piece of land, you're buying a productive asset for a period of time. So the amount that you sell for is the value of however many years of crops you could expect. So Elimelech has a piece of land. Now, I don't know whether he had sold it to someone when he left to Moab, maybe to finance his trip or get him set up in his new place. And you also remember the story of the daughters of Zelophehad. This is before the conquest under Moses. They're still in the wilderness. And Zelophehad had five daughters. And they go to Moses and say, hey, our father wasn't part of the rebellion. He just died. We would like some land. We would like the land he would have gotten. And Moses says, never thought of that. Moses then turns and asks God, what do I do with these women? And God says, give them the land. So the next thing that happens is they're getting ready to go into the land, and these ladies are part, I believe, of the tribe of Manasseh. And the tribe of Manasseh comes in and says to Moses, wait a minute, these gals have got this land. What happens if they marry somebody from another tribe? Then the land that belongs to our tribe will go to some other tribe. And Moses said, never thought of that, and goes and asks God. And God says that the daughters of Zelophehad or any other woman who inherits may marry anybody she wants, provided she marries within her tribe. Within her tribe, she can marry anybody she wants, but if she is the owner of the land, she is not free to marry outside of the tribe. What we have here is Naomi and Ruth are in the position of the daughters of Zelophehad, and so they've got land, and if you want their land, you have got to take the woman. Goes as a unit. And that will, of course, become important as we go on in the story. So 22 again. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young woman, lest in another field you be assaulted. So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests. And she lived with her mother-in-law. So this now goes through Shavuot, which is the beginning of the wheat harvest. The next piece of action we're going to get next week is back at the barley harvest. So it'll have been a year that she's there. There's just a whole bunch of stuff going on here. The other part of this that most Christians talk about, and I agree with, I'm not suggesting that they are in any way wrong, is this business of the near kinsman being a redeemer. And what you will hear in Christian circles, correctly, is one of the reasons that Christ came, and Christ came as a man, is because he is our kinsman, since he is a man and we are people. And so as a kinsman, he then has the right of redemption for us who have sold ourselves into slavery under sin. That's all stacked up in this story. So you've got the genealogy of David, who of course is the ancestor of Yeshua. You've got Bethlehem, where all of this comes together. You've got the idea of a kinsman redeemer being explained in this little book. And next time, you'll also see that a whole bunch of genetic lines all come together in that couple. So there's a lot going on for this short little four-chapter book that a lot of people don't realize.